This widely influential deity, Dagon, mentioned here in 1 Samuel 5, 1-5. He was honored, of course, by the Philistines, those perennial enemies of Israel, who lived in the southwest coastal plain of modern Palestine. Actually, the name Palestine is derived from the Hebrew word for Philistine, so that these sea peoples gave their name to the country we now know today. Dagon, however, was infinitely more than a Philistine god. He was honored in the five major cities of the Philistines, and for interest's sake, you'll find those listed in verse 17 of chapter 6. By the way, when you're studying the Old Testament, you usually have to read a good deal more than when you're studying a verse or section in the New Testament to get all the facts. He had a temple, certainly, in the major Philistine cities, though his cult spread as far as Mesopotamia, which was then a very large tract of country from the Persian Gulf, stretching right up to the east of modern Turkey. But you may remember that it was at his temple at Gaza, where 3,000 people gathered on the roof to watch the baiting of Samson. And you remember that famous story of God renewing Samson's strength that last time, and his pulling down the central pillars on which the roof and the whole building was supported, when hundreds, even thousands, were killed. Giving some idea, by the way, of the largeness of the temples that were built in the honor of this god. So Dagon's temple at Gaza had been demolished, but I think as we look at this little story, in a sense, you might describe what happened in his temple at Ashdod as an even greater humiliation. The Philistines, of course, were syncretists, just as most people are today. Notably the Prince of Wales, of course. He has a remarkable sympathy, doesn't he, with the views of the popular views of ordinary people. And he's espoused this cause of being a defender of faith rather than the faith, as you know. So the Prince of Wales, like so many people in our country today, are syncretists. So were the Philistines. It never crossed their mind that their god Dagon was the only god around. And when they captured the Ark of God, they wouldn't destroy it. On the contrary, they were absolutely delighted to be able to take it and put it alongside their god in the temple. In this way, they would feel that they were enriching Dagon's temple and adding to their pantheon of gods. No doubt young Philistines were taught at school the contemporary waffle that our own school children hear today, how one's spiritual understanding can be deepened by knowledge of the gods of other religions. At any rate, the Philistines were just like us. They would think it a good thing to have one more god in their temple. Alas, the God of Israel did not apparently subscribe to this complacent theory. The morning after the battle, when the people naturally came to stare in triumph at this fabled Israelite god, now safely housed in their temple, what did they find? Well, they found Dagon fallen to the ground, flat on his face before the Ark of the Lord. Hastily, perplexed and pained, no doubt, they picked him up and put him back on his podium. No doubt it was an accident, though rather a disturbing one, quickly to be forgotten, as all of us put unpleasant things behind us to forget them. But the following morning, a far more painful sight met their eyes. There was their favored idol plunged to the earth again. But this time, his humiliation is complete. He's smashed to pieces. He's been treated like a murderer in some Middle East countries today. He's been decapitated. And like a thief in such countries in the Middle East, his hands have been chopped off. Only what the Authorized Version calls his stump remains. His head and his hands, symbols of brain and action, lie on the threshold, waiting to be trampled by the crowds that come in to worship. It's a vivid little story, isn't it? A painful story for the Philistines. What does it mean for us today? Now, it's this question that I want to address this morning and next Sunday morning. But before we plunge into this particular fascinating little story, I want to say something about our handling of the Old Testament so that we may understand it in our own reading. I said last week that I'd received a moment of illumination as I left the Partnership Summer School at Ashburnham in the last half hour before we all departed. Sitting inside the front door at Ashburnham, there were three grinning boys of about 7 years of age. they were displaying with great pride the cars that they'd just been given. And they were very magnificent model cars indeed. I would guess they would have cost quite a lot. Valuable prizes. So there they were, sitting by the front door of Ashburn and grinning all over their faces as I passed them. And I said, "What are these for? How'd you get them?" "Why," they said, "these were the reward. This is the reward we've got for being the best dorm, the best dormitory." Well, yes, indeed. At the age of 7 or 8, when you put a number of small boys together in a dormitory, sticks and carrots are necessary. It had been already proved that week when some parents, looking out of a window at 2 o'clock in the morning, found a march of 7 and 8-year-olds walking round Ashburnham, who had to be gathered up and sent back to bed. But this particular happening, as I drove back to London that day, focused my mind very much on something that's been in my attention, really, I suppose, all the time we've been studying Galatians together. And keeping a hand in 1 Samuel 5, I'd ask you to turn to Galatians 4, and you'll see the link that came to my mind that morning as we left Ashburnham. Galatians 4:1. You may wonder what Galatians has to do with 1 Samuel, but it is just this point that I want to make. He's talking here about the Mosaic economy, and he's saying in chapter 4, verse 1, what I'm saying is that as long as the heir is a child, he is no different from a slave, though he owns the whole estate. He's talking about Israel there before the coming of Christ. He's subject to guardians and trustees until the time set by the father. So also, when we were children, we were in slavery under the basic principles of the world. But when the time had fully come, and then he says how God sent his Son and sent his Spirit. Now, the point there is that Israel, before the coming of Christ, were under the tutelage of guardians and trustees of the Mosaic economy, and therefore they were treated in some senses like children. The whole nation was in a time of schooling. Now, of course, I'm not saying for a moment that the giants like Abraham, Moses, and Elijah were children. Of course, they were not. They often put us to shame by their faith and their actions. But what I am saying is that the long years of Israel, Israel's history, the people were being educated and schooled and prepared for that day when Christ should come. Then school days would be over, and many of the ways in which they had been taught and educated in the Old Testament would disappear. And that's just what we find. Let's take this one example of rewards and punishments, the reward of 3 cars that were given to these 3 little boys. Now, you remember in the Old Testament that that is a frequent thing. You can think of passages like the end of Deuteronomy where there are long lists of blessings and long lists of cursings. Rewards are offered to the people on condition of obedience. They will have victory in their wars. They will have fruitfulness in the farm or the vineyard. They'll have prosperity in their business affairs. They'll have health and a long life. None of these diseases will come to you, that is, the diseases of the nations around them. Now, when we come to the New Testament, we find that these blessings and curses are not there. Generally speaking, the New Testament avoids such rewards and promises in this life. It has been said, hasn't it, the old saying, that prosperity was the blessing of the Old Testament and adversity is the blessing of the New. But what is so important for us is that we should not return to the immaturity of the Old Testament patterns, which is exactly what the Church of Corinth had done. And yet we find this temptation to the Church of God in this age all the time. Catholicism, for example, goes back, doesn't it, to temples and priests and sacrifices. That's not to deny Christianity, but to go back to an immature form of it. In the charismatic movement, we find people promising prosperity and health. I actually have a pamphlet at home called None of These Diseases, telling me that if I'm obedient to the Lord, I and those who depend upon me will catch none of the diseases which the nations around Israel and ordinary people today catch. Now, of course, I don't do that, do I, in my everyday life, and you don't do it in yours. I don't go into the office on Monday morning and get Liz Capper and say, "Liz, I'm going to reward you if you don't quarrel with Helen this week. And provided there are no rows and I don't find you escaping from your dormitory, at the end of the week I'm going to give you a reward. And if not, I'm going to punish you." It would be childishness to talk like this. We don't do that. So when I leave the Old Testament behind, I leave those promises of rewards and punishments in this life behind. I have to read the New Testament, the Old Testament, through the New Testament grid. So I won't see, for example, coming back to 1 Samuel, I won't see a copy of this kind of thing. I was visiting a very elderly member of our congregation many years back. He's now 90. I went to have tea with him about a week ago in Kensington with his wife. And I had about half an hour to kill because I arrived much too soon, and I knew they'd be worried if I rang the bell too soon. So I went into the Roman Catholic Church in High Street, Kensington, the Carmelite Church. It's very impressive inside. And there, at the far end, there is this tent which encloses Jesus Christ in the host, the tabernacle, where he is said to be alive and present. Now, that is what the Roman Catholics believe. They believe that in that great temple, the Carmelite Temple in the High Street, Kensington, the living Christ is there. And as I sat there in the cool of the day, many people came in and bowed before him. Now, whether we don't hold to that particular belief, but putting that aside, no Roman Catholic believes that if I went to the Neasden Temple, the Hindu temple in Neasden, and I brought one of the idols down, an elephant idol, and I put it there on a podium in the Carmelite Church in Kensington, and came in the next morning, that I would find that the power of Christ had overthrown the power of the elephant Hindu idol, and it was lying on the ground with its trunk off and its tail off, broken in pieces. Nobody believes that today, do they? Of course not. So the Bible is not intended to teach us that these things will be repeated, that the victory of God will be quite evident today in ways than it was in the Old Testament. How then am I to understand a story like this that belongs to the education of Israel long, long ago and is not going to be repeated today? Well, I'm only going to take one modern application of it this morning. I'm going to take more next Sunday, but because I've taken rather a long time on that introduction, I hope it was clear. We'll take one illustration of what this story certainly means for us today. And if I were to take a text for this morning, it would come from the last two verses of chapter 4, if you will look at it. Here is Phinehas' daughter at this time of great national calamity and disaster. She's in childbirth and she's dying. The midwives tell her not to despair. She's giving birth to a son, but she doesn't respond at all. She names the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel." Ichabod meaning no glory. And as you know, in Hebrew times, it's very common to give somebody a name that symbolized something that God was saying or doing at that time. The glory has departed from Israel because the capture of the Ark of God and the death of her father-in-law and her husband. She said, and it's repeated, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured." Well, what a bitter name for that little mite born that day. But of course, it's a very bitter time, not only for the wife of Phinehas, but for all Israel, especially Eli. As we read just now, the bitter news was brought to him from the battle lines by a Benjamite. And it's summed up under three headings in chapter 4, verse 17. One, a disastrous military defeat. The man who brought the news replied, "Israel fled before the Philistines, and the army has suffered heavy losses." What are those losses? Verse 2 tells us that in the first battle of Aphek, they were defeated and 4,000 men were lost. But in the second battle of Aphek, when the ark was actually captured, 30,000 infantry were killed. Where is that verse there? But you can see it if you look for it. I haven't popped it down in my notes. There it is in verse 10. Thank you. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. I glanced at the details of the Battle of the Somme, which I suppose remains in the minds of most people in this country as the most terrible day that we've ever suffered as a nation, when 58,000 casualties came in one day, July the 1st, 1916. So if you compare all the armies of France and Britain and Germany fighting on the Somme that terrible day, and compare that with this day, it is an appalling tragedy. A disastrous military defeat, then, is reported to Eli as he sits there, an old man, on his seat. But worse is to come. Next sentence in verse 17. Also your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. Two sons, the leaders of the priesthood, presumably heirs of Eli in the future. He's a very old man now. They will succeed. They're slain. Thirdly, much worse to come. The Ark of God has been captured. And many commentators have pointed out that it's at that point that Eli fell backwards off his chair by the side of the gate and his neck was broken. But surely before his neck was broken, his heart was broken. That was a shock. He could not survive. The Ark was captured. And when you're reading in the Old Testament, you often find that the point is made not by underlining it or writing it in red ink or with exclamation marks, as we do in our letters, by repeating the phrase over and over again. Do you see it here, verse 17? The Ark of God has been captured. Verse 19, when she heard that the Ark of God had been captured. Verse 21, she said, the glory has departed because of the capture of the Ark of God. Verse 22, the glory has departed for the Ark of God has been captured. I think suffice to say that the enormity of this disaster in the history of Israel seems to be equaled in the Old Testament only by the fall of Jerusalem in 587 BC, the only other time in the history of Israel in the Old Testament when it appeared that Israel might not survive as a nation, as an entity, any longer. These two points are the two worst points in the history of Israel. The capture of the Ark, the symbol of the presence of God, and the fall of Jerusalem at the beginning of the exile, the two terrible moments in history. And thus the word Ichabod does sum it up. It's not an exaggeration. For what is Israel without her God? He's abandoned them. His symbol is in enemy hands. The Victorians loved this text. You will find in Victorian times quite a number of sermons about Ichabod, usually preached by people of my generation, because the older generation always think that the past days were far greater and that the glory has disappeared. Ichabod was a favorite Victorian text, simply to point out that the great days lay in the past and we don't have these things today. So I want to ask this morning the question, was Phinehas' wife right? Did Ichabod spell out the departure of the glory of Israel or not? And to your surprise, maybe, the answer to that question is that it did not signify the glory departing from Israel. Superficially, maybe, but fundamentally, certainly not. And that's what we're going to look at this morning. True, superficially, Shiloh, from that moment, ceased to have any importance as a center of worship. As far as we can make out, the Philistines raised it for the ground. And in the 1980s, incidentally, there have been some interesting archaeological excavations, and it doesn't look as though anything remained for the rest of history until now of Shiloh. But if we put emotion aside and look calmly at the story, and don't see it as Phinehas' daughter naturally saw it, we shall see a very different situation. And that ought to have come to us. We ought to have been alerted to it. If we'd read, as Jess read just now, straight through the end of chapter 4 into the beginning of chapter 5. So often, you see, the sermons on Ichabod were about verse 20 and 22 and then finished. But if I go on reading in chapter 5, 1 to 5, although it seems the glory has departed from Israel, God is very much still alive and shows it throughout chapter 5. Let me ask the question then, what has been lost? In what sense has the glory departed? What has been removed from Israel? Well, I want to mention three things that stand out concerning the state of the people of Israel in chapters 2, 3, and 4. And incidentally, of course, one of the things you have to do when studying these chapters, these points in the Old Testament, is to read much more than you do in your New Testament reading. It always seems to be extraordinary.